What we're going to do now is switch topics and look at what the Bible has to say and maybe have some fun with this one, because this is based on Romans 1 verse 20. And that verse in essence says this: since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, which are his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood by that which has been made, so that mankind is without excuse. What does all of that mean? It basically means this: since the dawn of time, since the very beginning that mankind has observed anything, we can clearly see the hand of God in everything. We can clearly see design everywhere we look. And if you cannot see it, there is absolutely no excuse. The Bible tells us that we are all going to stand before God. We will all stand before God. And we will not be able to say, oh, I didn't know there was a God. He'll say, I made it plain to you through what I made. I made it plain to you. You just chose to believe something else. And in our society, you know, we're choosing to believe in evolution. And so that is how this verse kind of begins this whole program. And by the way, it's not like the evolutionists cannot see the evidence for design. They can. In fact, many of them admit it. Some very famous scientists, I'll just give you two quotes. We use these two in one of our Ranger Mike videos for kids to understand. One scientist said, biology is the study of living things that give the appearance of having been designed. Of course they give the appearance of having been designed. That's because they were. Another guy says, we have to constantly remind ourselves that even though everything looks designed, it wasn't. It evolved. Why is it that they have to constantly remind themselves? They have to constantly remind themselves because wherever they look, they are constantly seeing design. That's like looking at a car saying, that car just accidentally built itself. Somehow it just built itself. Okay, that's in essence what's going on. You are looking around, you are seeing evidence for design. So this verse brings it all together and says there is no excuse if you can't see it. So with that in mind, we just want to jump into this and have a little bit of fun with it. And I'm just going to show you some little things that I was able to get into my suitcase just by way of helping to illustrate this first part of the program. I'm going to divide into three different topics. The first one is every single creature on the planet shows amazing design. I'm just going to show you some that illustrate it in maybe a little bit more dramatic way. A chameleon, now this is a puppet of a chameleon. A chameleon is an astounding creature because of its ability to change color. That's only one reason it's astounding. But you know what it can do. You know that when it's sitting on a tree branch, it will literally take on the form or take on the look of the leaves around it. You can take a chameleon in a dead, dry tree with brown leaves, put the chameleon in it, and right in front of your eyes, it'll turn brown to match those leaves. If you take him out of that and put him over here in this bush that has green leaves with yellow flowers on it, it will turn green with little yellow spots to match the flowers. And the thinking end of the chameleon, isn't even aware of what's going on. It doesn't have to change its clothing to be camouflaged. It happens automatically. And so the Zulu people that I grew up with in South Africa, every time they would see a chameleon, they would panic and they'd try to kill it. So I remember saying to some of my friends one time, why are you trying to kill a chameleon? And they told me because they were really afraid of it. I said, well, I can see that you're afraid of it. Why are you so afraid of it? They said, because it has an evil spirit living inside. I said, it has what? An evil spirit? Why do you say it has an evil spirit? They said, how else can you explain it? It's changing color by magic. I said, it's not magic. It's designed that way. Look at all the other reptiles here in Zululand. Look at the ones that can climb trees or live on rocks. They can get away from enemies by climbing or running under rocks or jumping in water and swimming away or whatever they can do. Look at the chameleon. He can hardly move at all. If you're lucky enough to find a chameleon, the only chameleons I ever had, I found by chance, let me tell you, or might have been crossing a road or maybe digging a hole to lay her eggs, whatever. They are almost impossible to see. So every chameleon that they would see, they would think, well, it's got this evil spirit in it. And I'm saying, no, look how slow it is. God has given it the ability to hide because it has no other defense. And one of the other amazing things about a chameleon is the eyes can look independent of each other. This eye can be looking down, and this eye can be looking up. They can look, they're all Google-eyed. If you look at a chameleon from the front, their eyes are looking all over. So you wonder what's happening in their brain. You know, they must have two complete pictures. But when they see a bug, they make their head look over at the bug, and they make both eyes come toward it. Now what happens is when that both eyes look at it, it can see in 3D, and it can tell exactly how far away the animal is. And then another amazing thing happens. It has a real long tongue that sticks out and zaps the bug. If my chameleon was this long, large, and I never had one that was that big, but the tongue would be way out to here. They can see a bug over here, but the chameleon itself can just sit there totally camouflaged without moving, so the predators that would eat it can't see it. But it sees its prey landing near it, and it zaps it with its tongue. By the way, have you ever watched during the Summer Olympics, have you ever watched those, the guys on the rings, what do they call them, the gymnasts or whatever? They'll do something, I forget what it's called. It's called a something cross, I forget. But they're performing on the rings, and one of the required exercises is for them to sit like, hold like this. Their rings are here. They have to hold themselves straight like this out, and they have to maintain that for several seconds. Do you know that it takes a human being years to prepare for that and to get your arms straight? And a human being cannot do that for more than a few seconds. Watch a chameleon. We used to do this a lot. We'd hold them in our hand, and if they want to keep walking, we'd hold out our other hand like this, and so they'd reach over to get a hold of the other hand, and we'd keep pulling it back. So the chameleon would be holding onto our finger with these back legs, little scrawny back legs, and the whole body is leaning out like this, just straight out, without any effort whatsoever, being held on only by these little feet. It's amazing. I could spend the whole time just talking about how amazing a chameleon is, but that's just one creature. Let me show you something else. That's just one reptile. Let's go to Australia and look at this weird frog. There's a strange frog in Australia. When the mother has babies, she eats them. Now that is a recipe for wiping out your kind real quickly, right? But what is she actually doing? She is, in essence, eating her babies. Because anything else that she would eat anything like a grasshopper or anything that she would catch, the moment she swallows it, this frog has very powerful stomach acids that immediately completely break down the creature immediately. It just like chews into it chemically and rips it apart so the frog can digest it. But when she swallows her babies, in the skin of the babies is a special chemical that communicates with the lining of the mother's stomach so that it stops producing the acid. And the babies will slide into the mother's stomach where she incubates them until they're big enough to live on their own. While they're there, she can't eat, of course. When they're big enough to come out, she'll open up her mouth and all the babies will come out, and now they're fully functional. When they're out, her stomach will start producing acid again and she can start eating. Now just tell me by what random accident the babies got exactly a chemical in their skin that communicates with the lining of a mother's stomach to stop the production of acid. If that wasn't in place at the beginning perfectly, this creature is extinct immediately because it would wipe out her babies immediately. That's just one type of amphibian. We could talk about a zillion different types of amphibians. How about this? Here's a weird plant, and you all know what it is. Venus flytraps are very cool because they're involved in a world of carnivorous plants. And there's not just these guys. There's different kinds as well, like the bladderwort. Bladderwort is an amazing thing. It has a little cup and all these nice little hairs that aim into the cup. And at the bottom of the cup sits this nice sweet water. So the insects can sense the water. So when they come into the opening of the cup, they slide down, and all the little hairs just guide them right on down in, and they get into the cup of this thing, they drink the water. When they turn around to try to come back out, they discover that all those nice little hairs are like sharp spears aimed at them, and they can't get out. And they get absorbed. The stuff of science fiction, horror movies, right? Well, all those kinds of things. Every carnivorous plant has a lure of some kind. This guy has a lure of odor. It doesn't smell very good, but that's okay because without having any brains, no nerves, no muscles whatsoever, its main diet, and the reason why they're called Venus fly traps is because along comes a fly, and normally flies are on smelly things, right? Your garbage or things your dog did in the yard they haven't cleaned up yet and all that good stuff. So here comes a fly. Fly comes along, smells the odor. He thinks there's food there. So you've seen what happens. He comes along. He tries to figure out how to get the food. There's no food, of course. Next thing you know, zap, and the thing closes in on it. And you've seen the videos. You see the creature trying to get out. A lot of times you see him, you know, his legs are coming out. They're trying to get out. They can't get out because there's perfect little jail bars here. If the jail bars weren't there, well, the creature could just come right out. No big problem. But you know, this illustrates to me anyway, and I don't like to spiritualize everything, but when I first saw this, I first watched it happen, I thought, you know, that kind of illustrates to me what the Bible says about me trapped in sin. That fly is trapped. The only way that fly is going to escape is if I come along and open up the fly trap and let it out. Well, I'm not going to do that, okay? But that's what the Bible says about me and you in our sin. We are trapped and there's no way out, and we are going to get absorbed and we're going to have eternity to pay for our sin. But there's nothing we can do about it. We can't get out. But Jesus Christ has come along and through his death on the cross has provided a way out. So that to me, it's a neat little illustration of just something that's a biblical truth. Well, how about, that's just a plant. How about a mammal? One of the most popular animals, when we take our wildlife safaris, one of the most popular animals is a giraffe. Everybody loves seeing giraffes. Everybody likes to see them run. And but when they drink, they have to do this very strange thing. When they approach water, their necks are like 16 to 18 feet up in the air. All other animals, their heads are right down by ground level so they can drink, but not a giraffe. When a giraffe approaches the water, his first has to make sure that there's no predators around. And then he comes up to the water very carefully, and he spreads his front legs out. But that's not enough. That lowers his body, but that's not enough. Then he has to bend his front legs. That lowers the front of his body enough that you can watch his head coming down to the water to drink. But you know what? Then a weird thing happens to the giraffe because his neck is long and it's thick and it's full of blood. Have the same number of vertebrae in their neck that you do. And so the neck is long, thick, full of blood. When that head goes down to the water, all gravity just pulls all that blood down to its head. And while the giraffe is drinking, that blood pressure in his head gets so great that his head just pops, and that's why there's no more giraffes in the world. Their heads have all popped. No, I'll tell you what, that should happen because of another incredible design feature that God has put in a giraffe. When its head is up, the heart can beat. It has a huge heart. The heart can pump blood the whole way up to the head and back down. But when the head goes down, gravity should pull all that blood down to the head, and he should have all kinds of problems. Minimally, he should be dizzy when he lifts up his head each time. He should fall right over because all the blood is draining out of his head. But the giraffe has a very special part of his system that when the head goes down, there are sensors in the neck that sense that. So with the head down, the sensors close off valves in his neck that stop the flow of blood getting to his head. So when the head is down, the valves all shut off, and the blood doesn't get to its head. And there is at the base of the giraffe's brain is a special little pad that soaks up the little bit of blood that does get there. That way, if the giraffe puts his head up, the valves all open again, and there's no dizziness whatsoever. And you'd say to yourself, how in the world did that system evolve? How in the world did the giraffe get the very valves that it needs to protect it just when it's getting a drink of water? How did that change? How did that get added to its system? If it didn't have it at the beginning, pop goes the head or whatever, and they do no more giraffes. Everything has to be in place at the beginning or nothing works at all. You can't add this stuff over time. It doesn't work that way. Well, that's just one reptile, one plant, one amphibian, and one mammal. I suppose we could pick up one insect and one bird, but you get the idea. These are creatures that maybe represent some of the more odd or obvious creatures that we like to look at. But let me tell you something that is absolutely true of every single creature on the planet. I don't care what kind of creature it is, a gnat or a mosquito, anything. They all have in their systems of operation astounding things that will blow you away just like these. Like, have you ever watched a fly? I mean, no, when we see a fly, we just kill them because we don't like them. Have you ever watched a fly flying and suddenly they stop on the ceiling and suddenly they're upside down? How do they get upside down? Or you bring in food that's in a triple plastic wrapping, lay it on your kitchen cabinet. Before you know it, there are gnats there. How does a gnat smell things through three layers of plastic? I mean, just you have to ask yourself the questions over and over. How in the world did these creatures get the ability to do the thing? In South Africa, we had these reader books that we had to learn, you know, learning to read and getting ever more complex words. So what they would do, because we lived in a country that was full of wildlife, each of the readers were full of, each chapter was a different animal. And one of the chapters, and this book was in Afrikaans, which is a form of Dutch, that's how we learned the language. So in this book, one chapter was how the mosquito works. You and I, we see a mosquito, we just kill it because I don't want that thing stinging me. You look at this, you read this book, you read this chapter on the mosquito, and I was blown away. In fact, the very ending of that chapter said, "Hal je hoed voor hem af," which means take your hat off for this guy. Look what a mosquito can do. They are astounding how they work, yet you and I just kill them because we don't want them stinging us. Every single creature on the planet exhibits astounding design. That's sort of lesson number one. Here's lesson number two. And again, I didn't bring some of the props that I normally do because they helped illustrate this very well. Every single creature on the planet has an automatic knowledge of how to do anything to keep it alive in its environment. So when the springtime comes, now for about a month or so, we've been seeing robins up in our part of the world. And in fact, we always kind of vie in February, who's going to see the first robins arriving back in Pennsylvania? Well, by now, they're starting to build nests. And we see them doing this every year. But you and I get so accustomed to seeing things that we don't stop to answer or even ask the questions of absolute wonder. How does the robin know that she has to build a nest once she's pregnant? This might be her first time. Who told her that she has to build a nest? How does she know where to build it? How does she know what to build it with? How does she know what shape to make it? How does she know, you know, how big to make it? How does she know all of that stuff? Did she go to Robin School of Nest Building? No. She knows it automatically through what word? She knows it through instinct. Right, instinct. She knows it through instinct. What is instinct? Instinct is like a free education that all creatures have, so that they know how to function in their environment. That robin might not have ever done this before, but now she knows she's built the nest. Now she knows when she's going to lay her eggs. She knows that the eggs have to go in the nest. Then she furthermore knows that she has to sit on the eggs. How does she know she has to sit on them? And for how long? And then once they hatch, how does she know that she has to feed them? How does she know what to feed them and how often? See, the Zulu people used to bring me orphaned animals in South Africa, and I never knew what they were getting. Most of the people I didn't even know. They just knew that I was interested in wildlife and nature, and so they'd bring these things, these orphaned animals they'd find out in the forest or out in the veld, whatever, wherever they were, and they'd bring them and put them in a box or a bag, and they'd come knocking on, you know, this is Mike here, you know, yes, and you know, give me this box, and I'd say, thank you very much, what is it, you know, whatever. And of course, I never knew what was going to be in it when I'd open the lid. Depending on the number of eyes or legs or lack thereof, whatever, might determine if I wanted to hold it or not or attempt to. So anyway, I mean, I wound up with some of the most incredible creatures. I wound up with not only, you know, monkeys, but crows. And by the way, let me interject something here. I've had three pet crows in my life. There is not another animal in the world that will come anywhere near as close as the intelligence of a crow. I can tell you for absolute fact, a crow is by far the most intelligent creature I have ever come across. So if that is any indication of our supposed evolutionary past, monkeys are dumb compared to crows. So maybe you and I are bird brains, or maybe we're dumb monkeys after all, whatever. But I've had monkeys too, and they are nowhere near as intelligent as my crows. I can tell you all kinds of funny stories. Or you can even watch the tests they put crows through on YouTube. Watch the quizzes that they put them through, how they figure out tests. No other animal can figure them out. So anyway, I had all these animals. Some of them I was able to bring up to adulthood and let go, but a lot of them would die because I wouldn't know what to do. I would even ask local rangers, how do you keep a rail alive or a Galago? You probably don't even know what those things are. I didn't either when I got them. A rail is like a lily trotter with huge feet, and so a Galago is like a little half monkey, half whatever. Little thing that's a nocturnal thing that has huge eyes. If you see them at nighttime with their big eyes looking at you, you think the swamp monster's after you. Anyway, so some of these creatures would die. And I'd get so frustrated because, and I would cry because I thought I was doing everything I could to keep them alive. I had a whole flock of guinea fowl living under my bed at one time. Do you know what guinea fowl do at 4 o'clock in the morning, especially when they think that you're their mom? I mean, you know, so anyway, when these creatures would die, I'd get so frustrated because here I am. I think I'm more intelligent than these creatures, but yet I couldn't keep them alive because I didn't know what to do to keep them alive. Yet the mother and father, had they stayed alive, they knew by instinct exactly what to do. Now, if you ask any evolutionist, where did the animals get their instinct? Because they all know what it is too. It's like a free education that all animals have that allow them to function in their environment. It's not more than what they need. It's not less than they need. It's exactly all they need to know. Ask any evolutionist, where did the creatures get their instinct? They will always say, millions of years ago, stop right there, stop. The moment you say millions of years ago, you've now exited the realm of science because you can no longer observe or demonstrate or repeat the demonstrations. You're just going to make something up. So they'll say millions of years ago, the robin, having evolved to a certain state, figured out that that was a practical nest for itself. Let's just even assume that that's correct. How is that information automatically passed down to the babies? How? Some will say it's DNA. Well, it might be DNA, the structure of DNA, because DNA is a blueprint for building things. Instinct is knowledge. So how is knowledge passed on down? That's still a mystery. God simply said in the beginning, he made everything, he said it was good, and then he also said it is finished. That doesn't just mean that the zebra looks cool in his pajamas and so does the lion's having a good hair day. It does mean the animals are beautiful, but it also means they're finished. They're lacking nothing. From now on till the end of time, they will all know exactly, generation after generation, without having to learn it, they will know exactly what to do in the wintertime, exactly what to do in the summertime, exactly what to do to find a mate, what to do with babies, what to do when danger approaches. They don't have to learn it. It's automatic. There's no evolutionist that can explain where the creatures got their instinct and how it was passed on down. It is much simpler and takes a whole lot less faith for me to believe that God made them, programmed it in, put it in their little computers, whatever that is, and just said it's good. That means it's going to last right through till the end. So that's the second lesson we wanted to learn tonight. First one, every animal has its own amazing story to tell. Second, every animal has instinct that allows it to function in their environment. And the last lesson, before we kind of go on a safari around the world, and that's what this one is going to be, the things that we're looking at now will show you some amazing creatures around the world that illustrate it. The last thing is the size of everything. Why is the size of everything on the planet the size that it is compared to everything else? Why, for example, is a tree large? Typically, trees are large compared to you. Why isn't the tallest tree on the planet only that tall? Think about what you would not have if the tallest tree was only, you wouldn't have shade, you wouldn't have wood to build things, you wouldn't have fruit, you wouldn't even be alive because you wouldn't have oxygen if the tallest tree was all that small. Think about just, we don't tend to stop and think about the things around us, but if we do, we realize what a wonderful planet we live on and how beautifully it's designed. Why aren't ants the size of you? And imagine if they were. And imagine if you were living on an ant mound here, you know, with carnivorous ants in it, and suddenly you went to look in the hole and suddenly an ant the size of you came running out, then another one. Would you be able to outrun it? And if it caught you, would you be stronger than the ant? No. God has put in ants super strength and super speed relative to its size because he has specific jobs for ants to do. In many cases, they are like perfect little garbage collectors. They keep the earth clean and sanitized. If the ants were much larger, the whole ecosystem wouldn't work correctly. And just by illustration, we've watched the ants in South Africa do this. On two of our safaris, we watched a raiding column of Matabele ants. Typically, there will be anywhere from 300 to 400 of these things or more. There can be up to 600 of these things. And the columns will be maybe up to maybe 6 or 8 individuals wide, and the column will run for maybe 6 or 8 feet on the ground. And they're raiding. They're leaving their nest, and they're going out raiding. They follow this column. They're following the scent trail. They're looking for termites. When they find a termite nest or a termite mound, they'll raid it, and you can hear they make like a hissing sound. It's not a vocal cord thing. I don't know if it's their legs or whatever it's doing. If you're real quiet, you can hear them hissing. So I got video of it real close, and you can actually hear it. They'll go in, and they'll grab the termites out, and then they'll reverse and go back the same way, and they're carrying termites in their mandibles, sometimes 2 or 3 that are the same size that they are. That would be like you and me picking up 2 or 3 people, the same size that we are, and then running at 60 miles an hour with them. We have not been given that kind of speed and strength relative to our body because we don't need it, but the ants do. That's how they survive, and it works perfectly. So think about the size of everything on the planet. Think about mosquitoes. Aren't you glad that a mosquito is essentially tiny compared to you? I mean, like, here is a sound that we all hate to hear at night, especially when, you know, when they're out. We all hate hearing this sound when we're trying to go to sleep at night. Right past you, you hate that sound, right? Here's a worse sound. And you know why, too. When I do that for kids, they all go, but you're not making any sound. You know, that's the idea. Now you and I know that they've landed on us, and we now know what they're about to do to us. But the point is, we have to ask ourselves a question about that little, this little tiny mosquito that bothers us. But we have to ask ourselves a question, why is the mosquito not this big? But imagine, why not? I mean, we have parrots at home that are that big. Why not a mosquito? And by the way, imagine if mosquitoes were this big. And imagine how they sit on the walls, and imagine you say goodnight to your family and you turn off a light and close the door. She's hungry. She can sense you. Now she's going to fly down to you. She's not going to go, ee. No, because that's the little mosquito with the little propellers. She's got big propellers. She's going to come down, land on you and stick this thing in you and suck all the Pepsi out of you. You want her doing that? No, and you'd have to say to yourself, why isn't the mosquito that big? Because God said that big and no bigger, because as it is, you're going to cause more problems for people than any other creature on the planet. So there's size of everything. How about this one? How many of you, I shouldn't even have to ask this, we've all been stung by bees at some time of our life, right? Well, the bee that stung you, especially when you were a kid, you might have thought that the bee was this size when it stung you, okay, right? Everybody, kids always, dramatize things a whole lot. But bees are not this size. This is about 200 times the size of a real bee. Beekeepers will tell you that if an adult gets about 400 to 500 bee stings, it's fatal to us. We can't. If we get 1 or 2 bee stings, or 10, or 20, or 30, or whatever, unless you're allergic, it won't kill you because our bodies are designed to handle that much venom. But if about 400 or 500 sting us, we could not absorb that much venom, and we would succumb to that, and we would die. Most of us have gotten stung while we're kids, playing in the yard or whatever. So the kids are smaller than me. This guy's about 200 times the size of a real bee. So if bees were this size and sting any kid, that kid would already be gone. So we should all be gone because we're all probably stung when we were kids if bees were this size, but they're not. Why are bees small compared to you and me? And why is their sting relatively benign? Now, when you got stung by the bee, you probably got a bee sting. In South Africa, you had to be very careful because the bees that I grew up with were generically known as the African killer bees. And they're no more dangerous per bee, but they're dangerous as a group because they, when one of them is alarmed, they immediately give off a pheromone, and that means they would all the bees in the whole hive will come after you. So you didn't want to make them mad. So anytime there were bees, sometimes the bees would build a hive in the attic of our house at our mission station. And the hive would get so big that sometimes honey would run down our living room walls. Well, we couldn't have that because that attracts other kinds of creatures you don't want in your house. So had to get rid of them any way we could. One time, they moved into a large black box we had in our woodshed out behind our house. We used to keep wood in that shed because it was the only way we had to keep our house warm and for my mom to cook before we got gas. And so wood was the only thing we had. So we had to keep the wood dry, and in the woodshed was a huge box we used to keep kindling in. The box was empty, and the bees found it. So they made this huge hive inside. Every time you go in to get wood, you have to be real quiet, real careful, just not do anything to get the bees mad. But it sounded like a giant motor running inside that box, okay? So, that, you know, and you could see the bees coming and going out of the one end. So as long as you didn't do anything dumb, the bees were fine. One day, and my mom and dad left it there because they thought, well, maybe one day we can get honey from it, which they wound up doing. In any event, one day, my dad had borrowed the mission's tractor, little lawnmower tractor, and was mowing the lawn around our house on the mission station. Bees didn't mind that. They didn't care. But suddenly, a helicopter flew over. Now, we never had helicopters in our part of the world. My dad flew an airplane, yes, but the runway was on the other side of the station. And anyway, something must have bothered them with the throbbing of the rotor or something. The bees panicked when that thing flew over. They came storming out of their box. Who's the first person they saw? My poor old dad mowing the lawn. So here he is mowing the lawn, helicopter flies over. Next thing he knows, he's covered with bees that are stinging him. Bees everywhere. He jumped off the tractor. It kept going. It eventually ran into a tree and stopped. He went running down to the house. Bees went right after him. And he jumped into the house. He was stung head to foot, but the bees weren't done. They flew in all directions, everywhere around. They killed everything that moved. They killed my brother's rabbits. They killed everything. They killed everything just because a helicopter flew over. So you didn't mess with the bees unless your name was Mike Snavely, because then I was always too curious. So one day I was playing alone out in the yard, and I heard bees coming. Now, I had never seen bees swarming, nor did I even know what they were doing. I happened to hear it. I looked up at the house, which was maybe, I don't know, maybe 80 feet away or so away, and I saw above the house everything turning brown, and I realized these are bees coming up over the house toward me. So I thought, well, it's not going to do me any good to run to the house. I'm running toward them. So I did the only thing I could think to do. I dropped onto the ground and curled up and made myself as small and as still as I could. So I wasn't conspicuous at all. Here they came, and while I was lying there, they all turned and flew over to a hedge about 30 feet away. So there must have been a queen among them. She flew into there, and all the bees began to land on top of her. And the more they landed, it made this huge ball of bees in the hedge. Now, I'm lying on the ground, never having seen this. I have no idea what they're doing. And so I'm going, what are these bees doing? What are they doing? So I got up when they had all landed. I walked up and did one of these things. I snuck up, and I did this huge ball of bees. I thought, look at that. Well, I couldn't let well enough alone, you see. So I went and got a big, long stick. And I came back with the stick. And the stick had a fork at the end of it. So I was able to take the fork at the end of the stick and kind of park it along the branch like this right below the bees. And I kind of looked way back at the house where I was going to try to make my escape to. And I got all ready and went, whew, looked back there and suddenly went, and shook it. To this day, I can still hear what sounded like 1,000 lawnmower engines starting as those bees just fell off in clumps, dissolved into individual bees coming right at me. And I remember dropping the stick and running like mad with that gleeful horror of this little kid who's just performed some weird thing. Guys, have you ever taken those suction cup arrows, you know, and you see a big wasp nest, and if you manage to hit it, here come the wasps, and you run away with the same gleeful horror? Same deal here. I could hear the bees coming behind me. I sprinted across the backyard. I got to the house before the bees got to me, jumped inside. You know, I'm looking outside. Here are all these bees out there. And you know, you couldn't get me. Little boys don't always think. I didn't think that there might be somebody else outside. Fortunately, there wasn't. So anyway, I stood at the window and I was watching all these bees. They could see me. And they could see, they don't know what glass is, though. So they're coming after me, and they're bouncing off the window. Bing, 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 bing. They're popping off the window. I thought about that later, and I thought, you know what? That was really dumb. Because what if, in my sprinting to get away from the bees, what if I had tripped or put my foot in a hole or something and twisted my ankle and fell over? I would never have been able to escape those bees, and I would have literally wound up with a whole lot more than 200 bee stings, and I probably wouldn't have survived that night. How about, that's just bees. How about this guy? We all know what yellow jackets are, and especially, I don't know if they do the same thing here, but in the October part of our year in Pennsylvania, these guys get super active. And I got stung this year so many times just weed whacking along the trails that go past our house. But they can smell sugar a mile away. And so one time we were out camping, and I put pancakes on my plate and put the syrup there. No sooner did I put the syrup there, and here came the yellow jackets. So I thought, how in the world do you know that I've just put out sugar? So I took my fork and I moved all the yellow jackets to one side of my plate. As they kept landing, I said, no, you guys eat over there. So I ate over here, and as the yellow jackets were landing, I kept moving them off to the side of my plate. So then they were eating there, I was eating here. I watched one yellow jacket walk up to this big blob of syrup, and he ate the whole thing. But what's really funny to me is he couldn't take off then. He'd go, and he kept crashing on the ground. I did not realize, and that happened over and over, I did not realize that this guy would eat more than the ability of his wings to carry his body away. But in any event, even these guys, do you ever see one that's this size? No. But when you open up a can of Coke or whatever, sometimes these guys go, you know, come flying and they go zzz back and forth, and people go, oh, there's a yellow jacket, get him away, get him away. What if it was this size? What would you do? Ah, get out of here, you know. And no, if it was this size, you'd turn around and run like mad. But what if it came after you? Now, I don't know anything about a yellow jacket sting as far as how potent it would be if it was this size. But pretty much we have all been stung by these guys. We've all been stung by mosquitoes, probably bees, wasps, hornets, whatever. But yet it doesn't hurt us. I mean, the sting might burn or whatever. It might hurt us for a while. But if these guys were all this size, and they're that it would be much more dangerous. And if there are creatures that are much smaller than these, that if they were even the size of these guys in reality, we would be dead because some of their venoms are much more potent. So in other words, when you look at stinging insects, you can thank God that they are as small as they are and as harmless as they are, because the sting isn't necessarily meant for you. It's meant for defensive, for general purposes. But these guys are the stinging ones, and we can be glad they're as small as they are. Now, you've killed the mosquito that was bothering you in your room, because if you hear that little sound going around you, I have to get up and turn on the light and kill the mosquito. You've killed it, and now you go back to sleep, but something else wakes you up during the nighttime, and you figure, oh, did the cat get on the bed? So you reach over, you turn on the light, and you see this walking up you. Now, I know what you would do if you'd see a spider this size walking on you. You'd go like this, oh, isn't she cute? You know, no, you wouldn't. You'd probably just die of a heart attack right there. Save your venom, buddy. I'm gone. Now, I'm not going to say anything about spiders now, because we have a video back there. I have a whole program called Spiders, Ogres, Allies, and Architects. Spiders are one of the biggest allies on this planet you can imagine. And I've had so many people write to us saying, once I saw your video, I stopped killing spiders in my yard at all. You know, the ones in my house, I sometimes get rid of, but I stopped killing spiders because now I realize how cool they are. They are one of the biggest allies we have, and there's no spiders that's that size. The largest one on the planet is only about half that size. Only about half that size. But anyway, these guys are everywhere, and you want them to be there. And in fact, there's an estimated several hundred of them per square yard out where there are plants and grass growing and so forth, because they're everywhere. And you want them there because they're keeping the bug population down. If they didn't, you'd never be able to go outside on a beautiful day, because you'd be swarmed with bugs in your mouth, your hair, your eyes. They'd be everywhere. And they also keep the insect populations down that ruin tree life and so forth. So these guys are huge allies. Well, one other creature we want to look at is this. And you know what this guy is. A caterpillar eats leaves. That's all it eats in its lifetime. And you've never seen a caterpillar this size. If caterpillars were this size, if they were all this size, then you and I would be dead. Not because they would eat us, but because if caterpillars were this size, they would defoliate all the trees in the world, and then nothing could be alive. Think about the size of everything and how everything fits together perfectly in nature. So these guys eat only leaves. That's all he's ever eaten. And then one day, he stops eating leaves, and he crawls onto a branch and turns into a chrysalis, and eventually he's going to turn into what? A butterfly. Now you have to ask yourself some more amazing questions. When he hatches out as a butterfly, does he eat leaves anymore? No, his mouth is not even designed to eat leaves. In fact, he knows by instinct that he has to fly away. How does he know where to go now? How does he know where to find water or where to find nectar? How does he know to not go to an elephant ear or a stop sign? How does he know to go to a flower or to go to water? Again, instinct. It knows automatically. It doesn't have to learn it. It knows it automatically. And so when you think of the miracles that go on inside the life of a caterpillar, This guy is astounding, and we've seen this happen. I've watched cicadas go through this. The metamorphosis is astounding at how it happens. Typically, these guys are camouflaged. Caterpillars are camouflaged, so they blend in with the leaves around them while they're in that stage. But then when they know, again, by instinct, they've had enough, their bodies begin to change, they typically crawl onto a branch, they sew themselves on. They've never done that before, but they know automatically what to do. They sew themselves on, and then they strip their pajamas off. They literally strip their skin off, and then they become now what's known as a chrysalis. And then as the chrysalis sticks on that tree, and as the chrysalis sits there, it literally looks now no longer like a caterpillar. It's no longer green typically either to look like a leaf. It's now the color of the stick that it's on. This one's colored green, but they're usually not green. They're usually a brown color because they're now matching the branch they're living on. So now they're camouflaged again. Then after a while, the thing begins to wiggle a little bit and it begins to strip its skin off again, and out comes something completely different again. Here, the amazing metamorphosis takes place. And by the way, a cicada will go through this as well. I filmed the whole process with video, so it's astounding how it works. When the creature comes out, its wings are all curled up and shriveled up and small. But as they begin to fill up, as the body begins to pump blood all throughout the whole body and the wings, especially in a creature like this, there's a special kind of a glue, a special kind of a cement that is in the blood. And that cement begins to stick to the veins of the creature's wing and it begins to harden. In a few minutes, the wings are open, and a few more minutes, the wings are dry, and it can flap its wings and fly away. It is a completely different creature. No longer does it have 14 stubby little legs now. It has 6 legs. It's an insect. No longer does it have no idea where it is. It now has eyes and antenna. It can see and feel its way around. No longer does it eat leaves. It eats nectar. No longer is it limited to a tree. It can fly. No longer is it an ugly green worm. It's now a beautiful butterfly. This, to me, is one of the most fantastic sights in nature because it also illustrates to me the miracle of the new birth that Jesus Christ gives us. The Bible says that we are all sinners, and once we have accepted Jesus Christ's death as our atonement, his death, burial, and resurrection from the dead, we are new creatures. Old things have passed away. Behold, that means look, all things have become new. It's the perfect illustration from nature of the new life that we can have, but only through Jesus Christ. Well, with those things in mind, let's take a quick little safari around the planet and have a look at a few interesting creatures that help to illustrate some of the things you've just seen. Now, the lion that you're seeing in front of you here, you would not know. I mean, you can see that there's a lion there, but if you were in an impala or a giraffe, unless you would get an odor, a whiff of it, you would think that that's just a bush growing there. Which brings up another question. How does, of all the animals that all the other animals smell there, why is an impala not afraid of the odor of a zebra or the odor of a giraffe or the odor of an elephant? Why does it know automatically to be afraid of the odor of a leopard or a cheetah or a lion? How does it know that? Again, this is the stuff of instinct. They're not taught it, they know it automatically. It's what God did in them to protect them so they can smell danger and they can escape, hopefully. So the whole point then, hopefully for them, the lion needs it too. But here's a creature that has buried himself in the sand, and the only part of it you can see is the eye of the frog sitting there. And it can still see its prey, but the creatures that prey on the frog cannot even see it there because it's buried in the sand. If you walk up the sand a little bit further, you'd say, oh, look at these pretty little beads in the sand. If you go to pick up those pretty little beads, you would discover that those are the eyes of a rattlesnake that is buried in the sand, and you'd get a nasty surprise trying to pick them up. Here's my buddy, the chameleon. And here again, chameleons don't just sit in the bushes like this, but this one is out. I mean, they do sit in the bushes, but they don't tend to move around a whole lot. This one is sitting right out in the open, which they don't tend to do. And you can already see its skin is changing to match its environment. And by the way, chameleons can use their skin to communicate with other chameleons. A chameleon can communicate to another male or to a female just by its patterns and its colors on its skin. It's amazing. It can do that just by changing its color. Or if you get a chameleon mad, they will turn very dark in color, and they have this big balloon thing that they can blow up at the bottom of their mouth, and they can hiss real loudly. But a chameleon can hardly bite at all. I've been bitten by chameleons, and the thing is, if you're lucky enough to find a chameleon, you can just put your hand in and walk up. It'll walk up onto your hand as though it's tame, because they just their only means of defense is their ability to hide. That is it. So there's no other. That's their only ability to hide. Well. And then when they're going to where they're going or when they're stopping somewhere, look at this guy. You can hardly even see him, even though he's out in the open. Look how he blends in with all the colors around him. And while they're sitting there very still, the eyes move all around. One eye can look up, the other eye can look down. It's an amazing thing to watch a chameleon. Well, some creatures hunt by looking for the shadow of a bug or something that's moving along a tree or along the ground. So look what God has done to protect some creatures, like this leafhopper. He's protected him by making him so his legs can collapse underneath his body and he can pull it flat right along the tree so that there's no shadow as he moves along. Same thing with this caterpillar. This caterpillar has these like strings on his body that go out away from the body so that as he walks along, there's no shadow. So you hardly even know there's a caterpillar there. Now look in the middle of this flower. What do you see? In fact, let me blow it up a little bit so you can see it clearer. In the middle of the flower, there is a yellow crab spider. The crab spider is sitting on this flower. It has very poor eyesight. Now, you and I, because we can think cognitively, that means you and I can see things, we can reason it through, we can process information very quickly. You and I can look at that spider sitting there, and you and I can immediately know what's going on. We can immediately say, okay, for one thing, the spider's camouflaged. The second thing, it's sitting in the middle of the flower. It's waiting for a bee or a butterfly to come along to get the nectar. It's waiting for a meal. You and I can see that immediately. Now, here's something that you might not know. The spider has no idea why she's sitting there. She has no idea why she's sitting there. She has never seen a butterfly. She's never seen a bee. She has no way of knowing what they eat. She has no way of knowing that she's sitting on their food source. She's even oblivious as to their existence. She has very poor eyesight. She's sitting in the middle of this flower by instinct. She sits there quietly. God tells her where to go. She might be attracted by the color or by the odor. We don't know. She can sit right down in the middle of the flower, and if she follows her instinct and waits very slowly, crab spiders, by the way, work very, very slowly. They're not rapid hunters like a jumping spider or a tarantula. These guys work very slowly. While the butterfly or bee is there trying to get the nectar out, she just moves her legs real slowly and pulls silk out of her spinnerets and begins to just wrap it real slowly. By the time the bug tries to fly away, it can't move its wings properly, and they don't even know that they're being wrapped up. It happens so slowly. But she has never seen it. How does she know to sit on that flower? Again, it's phenomenal instinct right in front of your eyes. Some spiders don't have any camouflage, so they make their own, but they don't even know that they need it. This trapdoor spider is very cool because it makes a hole in the ground, lines it with silk, makes a door that looks like the ground around it, and then puts some threads all around her hole there. That if an animal comes walking along, an insect or a bug comes walking along, it'll trip on one of those lines. She'll feel the vibration. She'll come open up her door, grab the bug, go back down and close the door. And so here's what she's doing. Now, this grasshopper walking at about 4 o'clock, you can see a green grasshopper walking there. The grasshopper has tripped on the line. She's coming. She's opening up the door. She's saying, "Hi, welcome to supper. By the way, you're it." Now, there's a very cool little segment of our spider video. I love the segment. You guys all know what a roly-poly is, right? They're like little ball millipedes. You see them, you touch them, they roll up, okay? So this little ball millipede is walking along the ground. It trips on a trapdoor spider's webs. The door opens, the spider comes out, grabs the little roly-poly, down it goes, door closes. Oh, poor little roly-poly. The next moment, the door opens, spider comes out, spits a thing out, it rolls away, spider goes back down, closes the door, the roly-poly unwinds and keeps walking. They were both following their instinct. As soon as the spider felt the vibration, it went out and just grabbed whatever was there. The roly-poly, from its perspective, said, "Wait a minute, I'm not supposed to suddenly be grabbed and hauled underground. I'll roll up and follow my instinct." The spider could not get its fangs into that hard shell, so I thought, what did I catch, a rock? Out it goes, spits it away, and out it goes. It is a very cool little clip. Anyway, Some spiders don't need any camouflage because in their bodies there are venomous or there are poisonous fluids. By the way, there's a difference between venom and poison. Poison is something that you ingest. Venom is injected. So you're injected with venom from a snake or a spider. You are poisoned if you eat something. That's why animals can eat venomous snakes and not die, because they are not getting the venom into their blood system until it's processed by the acids in their stomach. So venom is injected, poison is ingested. So these guys have poisonous body fluids so that if a bird were to eat them, the bird might die. So God has given many of those creatures that have poisonous blood in their bodies bright or contrasting colors on the outside to warn other creatures. So those other creatures that can perhaps see in color would know by instinct, avoid the ones with bright colors. But how would they know? Why would they know that? Because a bird does not know what poison is. A bird does not know what dying means. It would have no way of knowing that. But by its instinct, it says, avoid the bright colored ones. It would have no way of knowing why. But it does. Instinct works so perfectly. And you think about it, every single creature on the planet has its own unique set of instincts. How could evolution ever explain that? Except just purely wishful thinking and hiding the miracle of it behind the millions of years. Because they can't see it happening. They have no idea how it happened. They have no idea how mutations produced any more order, any more information. So they just assume that it happened, and the mechanism is hidden behind millions of years. How convenient. In any event, so some spiders don't have any camouflage. So, you know, they don't need them because of their bright their bright colors. But, you know, there are some frogs that have bright and contrasting colors, too. These are called poison arrow frogs because if you take your arrows or your spear tips and shoot them into the, you know, get some blood of these guys onto the spear tip and then shoot that into a deer, it's so poisonous it will kill the deer. So these guys are called poison arrow frogs. They have bright colors on the outside. Don't eat me. I got very poisonous body fluids. Now you can even, some frogs are so clearly marked that even you would know to avoid them. Yeah, you know, there's certain butterflies you might want to avoid as well, because you might get bitten by them. Anyway, you get the idea. So look at this guy. This guy's about 4 inches long. It's a type of grasshopper. It can make a loud clicking noise if you approach it. It would normally be camouflage if it's sitting on a dry, dead log. That would be its first defense. Its second defense is to make a loud clicking noise. If that doesn't scare you away, it can unfold its primary wings, showing you its secondary wings, which are bright red. That might scare you away. If that doesn't scare you away, look at that foam that it's putting out by its legs. That foam stinks worse than a skunk. So this guy's got a lot of good defenses on him. Now, you know what this guy is. A mantis is considered one of the friendly insects. You can put your hand down, and a mantis will walk on you. Try that with a cicada, they'll fly away. So they're considered a friendly insect. But you would want to be careful with one that's doing this, because this one is alarmed already. She's folding out her wings, making her look bigger than she really is. She's got her front legs folded up to protect her head. You can see all the thorns there on her leg, those sharp things. Her mouth is wide open. If you try to pick her up now, you'll get a bite and you'll never pick up another mantis. But while she's in this position, look at her back legs, because they're designed for walking around. The front legs are designed for attack. Look how thick and muscular those legs are compared to the back legs. You can see this guy is designed for attack. And these are one of the best insects for your garden, bar none. They will catch a lot of real pesty bugs. Well, there's a lot of other creatures that have amazing defenses on them as well, like porcupines. In the game reserve I worked in, they found a leopard that was dying because it was starving because it had a face full of quills. So they darted it, brought it into the camp. They pulled the quills out. One of the quills had gone through the leopard's tongue and was 2 inches into the roof of its mouth. So that shows you how hard a porcupine can ram. So it took a while to kind of nurse that leopard back to health. On one of the nights, one of our rangers came across 13 lions. Each lion, like, what, 500 pounds, surrounding one porcupine in the road. 13 against one. Guess who won? The porcupine won, because the lions could not figure out how to get around that battery of quills. Other creatures can fold up to protect themselves, like scaly anteaters and armadillos. And here's the roly-poly that I was just talking about with the spider. Now let's go down under the water and have a look at some amazing things. What do you see here? Well, you see a poisonous sea anemone, right? But look right in the middle. I can't point to it now because these pointers don't work on a TV monitor. But if you look smack in the middle, you can see an invisible shrimp. Right in the middle, you can see its two eyes. At the bottom end, the two little blue things are the tail end of the shrimp. You can see the two long antennae there. Every part of its body is invisible. How did that happen? The exoskeleton, all the organs, all the muscles, everything's invisible. How did that happen with this one shrimp? Look at this guy. He's hiding among the seaweed, but look carefully. Is he actually hiding among the seaweed? No, this is a sea dragon, and that fish is not hiding among seaweed. He's hiding among the parts of the dragon that look exactly like seaweed. Look, it even has fake young growth at the top. So it even looks like a plant growing down in the water. You look at this guy and you say, wow, this shellfish creature is pretty camouflaged here. Well, you might think so, but not to the creatures who know to eat him. So when they approach, watch what this guy can do when danger approaches. Watch what he can do in a matter of moments as danger approaches. Now you see him, now you don't. How does he do that? How does he know to put out the right color, the right number, the right everything, so he perfectly blends in with the coral all around him? Let's come back out onto the land and look at another type of crab spider. This crab spider is sitting on a leaf. Before she sits down, she spins a little bit of web on the leaf and she sits down right in the middle of it. Now, she can't possibly know what she looks like, but most creatures will not eat her because she looks too much like a bird dropping. How many creatures do you know that go around eating bird droppings off of leaves? Any creature, she's not camouflaged. Any creature that would normally eat a spider like this would have a great meal here, but they don't know that that's a meal because it doesn't look like a meal. But this spider, for her part, she's never seen a bird. She doesn't know what a bird eats. She doesn't know anything about a digestive cycle of a bird. She doesn't know that a bird puts droppings out. She doesn't know anything about that. But her instinct says, spin a little bit of web and then sit right out in the open, right on top of it. And then if you follow what your instinct says, you won't get eaten because you look like something that nobody else wants to eat. Well, if you look at this beautiful flower, an insect comes landing on the top of it to get some nectar and instantly gets caught and eaten. Why? Because everything you're seeing there is a mantis. It's a praying mantis. All those things that look like petals of the flower are legs of the mantis. But it looks so much like a flower. Look at another weird bug. This creature is a longhorn grasshopper, and its wing that you're seeing there in the upper part of the picture is its wing. It's not a leaf. But if you look at it, it even looks like there's false chew holes of caterpillars around the edge, and it looks like there's fungus growing on the leaf. But that's not leaf fungus, and no caterpillar has chewed there. This is the wing of the creature, and even has false fungus and false chew holes to complete the mimicry. Now show me how evolution could have ever produced that. This guy looks dead, doesn't he? He's not. He's just imitating a leaf that's drying out. And every time you watch a leaf that's drying out, where you see the green receding and the brown is there, you'll see always a yellow patch in between. That's exactly what this creature is doing, is imitating a leaf that's drying out. Absolutely astounding to me. Well, you know what this guy is. It's a stick insect. He's easy to spot. This one's a little harder. He's right in the middle, but you can see four legs. What's he do? Where's his other four leg? Where are his other two legs? Right smack in the middle of the screen is the head of the creature. It's holding its two front legs together like this and holding them straight out over the end of his body, making him look just like the ends of the blades of grass. How does he know to do that? Look at this guy. This is a caterpillar. You might say, where's the caterpillar's mother? Its mother is a moth. The mother has no idea what the babies are. She lays her eggs, she flies away, she dies. But before she lays her eggs, she selects an acacia tree from South Africa. She lays her eggs there. Why does she select an acacia tree? She doesn't know why. Why doesn't she go to a banana tree or a maple tree? If she did, her babies would not look like those leaves, and they could be seen and eaten right like that. But she knows by instinct to go to an acacia tree. She doesn't know why, but you can see the wisdom of her instinct of doing that, because now her babies are camouflaged. Look on the forest floor again. Look in the upper left corner. There is looks like a leaf, That's not. It's a moth sitting on the forest floor. It even has a fake vein running wingtip to wingtip. You think that's weird? Look in the lower right corner. That is another moth, but it looks exactly like a dried up leaf, the brown one in the lower right corner. Now, this is one of my favorite ones. Here's the moth sitting sideways. Can you see it? Let me highlight it so you can see it better. There's the moth. You can see the head, the thorax, you can see the wings. How does this moth know to even sit this way on a tree? It didn't look in a mirror to see which way the stripes on its wings go. How does it know, apparently, to orient itself in a tree so that the lines line up with the tree? It doesn't know that. How would it know to do this? Well, let me wrap it up by showing you something funny. These are my caterpillars that I'm teaching to stand on their heads. No, seriously, let me show you a couple funny things. Here's a butterfly, and a bird swoops down from the left and grabs all that stuff at the left of the butterfly, thinking it's getting a meal. But instead, it gets a mouthful of powder. Why? Because that's not the head and the body. The head and the body is in the lower right corner. How does it get all that stuff at the back that looks just like an insect back there? Let's go over to Borneo, over to Southeast Asia, and look at the lantern beetle. On the left side of the beetle, you can see its two antennae sticking out. You can see its eyes. There's its in its mandibles at the front. It's walking to the left. Wrong. It's walking to the right. The right end of this is the head. Over there, they call it the wrong way beetle. I wonder why. And this is the rare pillow-imitating couch dog. When we tell Holly it's time for her bath, she jumps on the couch and tries to look like a pillow. It doesn't work. We see her and she gets her bath. Let's go over to Europe and look at the European nightjar. This is a bird that is sitting out in the open. This is like a whippoorwill or like one of those types of terrestrial birds. She lays her eggs on the forest floor. I can't point to it again, but you can see on the left side of the screen, you can see her beak and her head. Her eyes are mostly closed. They're not fully closed, but they're mostly closed. Why? She's squinting. She can see you. She can see everything that's going on, but she's squinting. Why is she squinting? People don't know. Scientists don't know. They think it's because there are birds like hawks and eagles that have very, very good eyesight. And when they're flying over like this, looking out, they can see the circle of that eye, that black circle of the eye. So when danger approaches, this bird will squint, hiding the circle of the eye. By the way, what you can't see is that right in front of the mother, there are four babies on the ground already doing that. By instinct, the mother didn't even need to teach them. Astounding. This is one of my favorite birds, the ptarmigan, because it looks like leaves that fell the autumn before, so it's camouflage no matter where it walks. But in the wintertime, it's not going to be camouflage anymore. But that's okay, because God has taken care of that. As the snows begin to fall, its feathers begin to change to bright red, pink, green. No, change exactly the color they need to. And when the feathers are all changed, the bird is so well camouflaged, you can hardly even see them sitting there. Here's a whole flock of them sitting on the ground. You can hardly even see them except for their little beak, the beak and the eye. Now, let me show you this. What animal are you seeing here besides the elephant? Do you see it? It's right in front of you. It's a white rabbit right in the front, right in the middle at the front. It's facing to the left. You can see its front paws, its nose, the top of its head, and its ear. Let me wake it up and you should be able to see it. Boo! Now do you see it? Now you can see the rabbit. Its eyes are open, right in the bottom corner here. Right in the bottom. But now look at that eye. It doesn't match all the sticks and little lines that make up the stick. So a hawk or an eagle can fly over and see that circle there doesn't match the sticks around there, and it could maybe spot that there could be prey there. So let's put the rabbit back to sleep. Go to sleep, little bunny. Okay. Now you can't see the rabbit anymore because she's totally camouflaged. Well, to wrap up, let me show you something called Batesian mimicry. I find this funny too because it's astounding. Do you know what that thing is? That's a wasp. Do you just want to go up and grab it? No, because you know what it'll do to you. So some creatures that eat insects will sometimes grab a bug like this, get a painful sting, and they'll go, ow, that thing hurt. I'm never going to go after a bug like that again. So look at some creatures that look like a wasp. That's Batesian mimicry, is when you look like something else that's dangerous, and thereby you maybe stay alive. So there's a wasp. But this beetle is completely harmless, but it looks like a wasp. It looks like it could sting. Same thing with this completely harmless moth, but it's got the same color patterns and even the same wing shape as a hornet. So it can be sitting on a branch looking just like a hornet that will sting you. So creatures just stay away thinking, ooh, that's a nasty hornet there. No, it's just a completely harmless moth. Same thing with this mantis. Even though this is a hunter, a lot of creatures will avoid it because it looks like something that can sting. Well, how about this ant? There are a lot of creatures that do not like eating ants because they're very bitter tasting. But they could eat that ant. Why? Can you see why they could eat it? Right. What did you say? Say it again. There's too many legs. How many legs does that ant have? 8. Which means what? It's not an ant. Well, wait a minute. An ant has 3 body parts because it's an insect. A head, thorax, and an abdomen. Am I not seeing a head, thorax, and abdomen? No. The 2 body parts on the right are 1 body part, the cephalothorax of a spider. The goddess put a little constriction there, making it look like 2 body parts. And this spider will take the front pair of legs and move them around like the ant moves its antenna. The spider has never seen the ant. So how does it know to imitate the antenna of an ant by taking its front pair of legs and doing that? We actually have a video on our spider video of one of them doing it. And it can even walk among the ants, and it puts out the same odor as the ants, so the ants don't know there's danger among them. That's astounding to me. If you climb a tree in Africa, be careful, because you might put your hand on a snake that's sunning itself, and you might get bitten. But you wouldn't have to worry about that. This is not a snake. This is a caterpillar that looks exactly like a snake head. I've had lots of vipers, and that looks just like a viper head. Well, the last creature I'm going to show you tonight is this guy from South America. It's a cicada. It's a large one, about 4 inches long. But look at the left side of it. You can see its eyes. That big thing sitting on the end of its head is like a big hollow eggshell. It's a big hollow thing called a casque. Look at another one. Something has alarmed this one, so it opens up its primary wings, revealing 2 big fake eyes that it doesn't even know it has, but just by instinct it will do that. And if another creature sees that, like a bird, it might think, ooh, there's another creature there with big eyes. But again, look at the very top of the picture, look top of the insect, you can see that big casque on the side, on the top of it, at the front of the bug. On the last picture, look at the casque alone. There you can see the real eyes, right, kind of to the right side. And the whole thing that looks like a peanut here, it looks like false eyes there, nostrils, teeth, even scales of what, a reptile, crocodile, dinosaur, who knows? Now, folks, how in the world does this get this casque on its head that looks exactly like another creature that will scare other ones away? We could go on and on and on and on talking about the astounding world of nature around us. But what I wanted to leave you with is just a drop in the bucket to leave you with the message of every single creature. I don't care what it is, how small, how big, how insignificant you think it is. Every single creature has its own amazing things it can do, its own amazing design. Number 2, every single creature has its own unique instinct that helps it to survive in its own environment. Take it out of the environment and it won't work that well. But in its environment, it knows exactly what to do and it works perfectly. 3rd thing, everything is perfectly designed and shaped for everything else. The whole ecosystem works perfectly or it doesn't work at all. That is the contrast between the evolution model that says, we have no idea how it happened. It just happened by blind chance. Now you flip that coin over and you can clearly see what many even evolution scientists have said, we can clearly see design. They just choose to stay blinded by saying, no, it just happened by chance. So now tomorrow morning, we're doing 2 sessions, one of them called The Horror of the Flood. Many pastors have told us that that is our most important session. And I understand that because it covers a lot of topics related to evidence for evolution that they use as evidence for evolution. But it also helps us to understand because a lot of Christians cannot answer some basic questions like, where would the water have come from that would have literally covered the whole earth? 2, where did it all go? See, back when I was young, When I would read that, I just believed it. I had no idea where the water came from, where it went. It didn't matter to me. If the Bible said it, I believed it. Well, that's, we are living in a post-Christian world, and there are many people who say, look, you Christians, if you want me to believe something like that, you're going to have to show me a little bit more evidence and a little bit more explanation as to how that all happened. Tomorrow morning session will give you the answers for a lot of those questions that you might not have had an answer to up to this point. Then the second session is called The Return to Genesis, and an amazing look at the book of Genesis and why it's important for us to actually be in it. Then we'll finish up tomorrow night with The Mystery of the Dinosaurs, and then Lost Secrets of the Ancient Civilizations. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you so much for the pizza and the meal. It was wonderful. Hope to see you tomorrow.